Hello, so this is Dhamma Mega here at Adishtana, and I'm sitting with Dhammarati, who, as you may know, has been on sabbatical and then a three-month solitary at the end of last year. So what were you up to, Dhammarati?
Did a little bit more on the sabbatical, actually. It also involved hill walking in the Lake District and a week in New York looking at mainly post-impressionist painting in the Met. But yeah, the retreats were the biggest part of it. And actually, a little bit, you know, when I was planning it, I thought of what are all the things that I haven't had time to do in the last few years. So hence the hill walking and the art galleries. But actually, the retreats were the most satisfying part of the sabbatical. It felt like the kind of richest experience, which was interesting. And I did two retreats, actually. I did 3 weeks in paradise, basically 3 weeks in North California in August. In a lovely little cabin that Shunyamala and her husband very kindly made available. And then I did, interesting contrast, a 10-week retreat in North Wales in November and December, which was quite different from California in August. And
that was a solitary?
They were both solitary retreats, yeah. And maybe I could just say, first of all, I love solitary retreats. I think it's such an unusual experience in this culture. Like, you've got a chunk of time where there are no demands on you externally. You know, just that there's nothing that you have to do, there's nothing that you have to respond to. And having that kind of freedom just to allow something a bit more sort of spontaneous or immediate to come up is such an experience of freedom. It's fantastic. And sorry to go on at such length, but set against that, you know, like on the first retreat, for example, you know, that old gag about how much money it costs to keep Gandhi in poverty. And I was thinking just how many people had helped me and supported me to be on solitary, you know, like from the people that I work with, you know, encouraging me to go, I'm sure for the best of reasons. That, you know, like the people who took me shopping in San Francisco, Shunyamala making her place available. I really felt like the solitary was very much supported by the broader community. A bit paradoxically, one of the kind of common experiences on the retreat a lot of the time was just appreciation and gratitude for other people.
So what did you do when you were on your solitaries?
It varied, actually. I'm afraid the sort of first reply would be I did whatever I felt like doing, which again is one of the great benefits of it. But I've been on retreat kind of often enough. There's a definite kind of shape, I think, to the way I like to have a retreat programme going. And, you know, like some days it would be a little more informal and I'd go for walks, and some days a bit more structured and a bit more formal. But what I found myself doing, I mean, like at the beginning of the retreats, I was doing quite kind of systematically different aspects of the system of training. So I was looking at mindfulness, I was looking at metta, I was looking at the, you know, those sort of deeper reflections on self-identification and so on. So it's been quite systematic. But I was doing a lot of study on the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Suttas. And as the retreat went on, I found myself just getting more and more interested and more curious about the process of mindfulness, almost. You know, in the Anapanasati Sutta in particular, you get this beautiful structure where you're looking at the experience of the breath and the body, you're looking at the experience of feelings, you're looking at the experience of what your mind does, and then you're looking at the kind of deeper nature of all of your experience. And so, like, for example, towards the end of my second retreat, which is where it was kind of a bit more systematic, I'd sit down in the morning, and I'd do the traditional four-stage mindfulness of breathing, the form of which mainly comes from the Visuddhimagga. I think I'm a born-again four-stage mindfulness of breathing practitioner. I loved counting after every out-breath. It was wonderful. but then what I did during the rest of the day, I'd have a second period of meditation after coffee and a bagel, looking at breath and body. I'd follow that with a just sitting. I'd have a tea break. I'd have a second double meditation, just taking awareness into feelings, have a bit of a break. I'd have a third double meditation, looking at sort of mental states. I'd have a bit of a break in the afternoon. So like in Wales, you're definitely doing a rainy season retreat, even if you're there for months. But, you know, if it wasn't absolutely bucketing down, I'd go for a walk on the moors. And then in the afternoon, doing study around Satipatthana, Anapanasati, looking at the scriptural sources, looking at the commentarial sources. And it was fantastic the way the study and the sitting practice supported each other. And then I'd have another session looking at the reflection on the Dharma section, looking at the lakshanas, looking at impermanence, looking at anatana. It just grows so naturally out of the earlier stages. And along the way, I'd do a bit of metta-bhavana, I'd do a bit of bodhicitta practice, I'd do a bit of just sitting so that those positive emotion elements were explicitly there. But I mean, I think the thing that was most satisfying about it was being able to have that kind of time to just notice the quality of your experience, to be able to investigate it for days on end, and just more and more subtly look at what the mind does. So it's very, very satisfying.
When you came back, we went for a walk. It was only, I think, the second time that we'd met each other.
Yeah.
And you said two things that really struck me. The one was that on your solitary, you had confirmed that you were, in fact, a Buddhist.
It's always good to check.
And the second was that you had decided that coming back and working for the International Council was, in fact, what you wanted to do.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me just sort of joining up the dots a little bit. So there was one, I had this little circuit on the moors that I would do most days. And actually, it was a great way to think you're walking through a bog in your high-end Wellington boots. And just there's time to kind of think as you walk. And there were sort of four questions that came to mind just really spontaneously one afternoon, and it was, what do I need to do to deepen my own spiritual practice? What does the movement need, and what am I good at? And in a way, when I confirmed I'm a Buddhist, I just came away with so much kind of confidence in the practice, just how rich and how satisfying the simplest practices are. But thinking about what I wanted to do, there was an element of just thinking I've benefited so much, so deeply from Dharma practice. Really, what I want to do is whatever way, just help make the Dharma available in a way that's effective. I want to work collaboratively with other people to do that. And in terms of my own sort of interests and skills, like I think I've probably got a wee bit more of an abstract turn of mind than some people. So some of the work that I've been doing where you're trying to get big movement-wide discussions going, clarifying certain principles, clarifying sort of certain structures, I'm actually really excited about some of those discussions. So the idea of coming back, and I think what we're trying to do with the International Council, where you're trying to get it's almost like the movement as a whole becoming aware of itself. You know, you're trying to get people involved in the movement in different countries and different continents, aware of each other, talking to each other, sharing experience. There's something about creating community that I think's intrinsically to do with the nature of the Dharma. I think that, you know, quite often in Buddhism you talk about sort of seeing no self, but I think a reflex of that, a move away from self, is a move towards self and other. And I think coming into relationship, creating community, is really central to Dharma practice. And I think trying to kind of, in a way, create community in this one Sangha, in this sort of single tradition, I think has central spiritual value as well as being organisationally necessary. So trying to create a conversation where there's that sort of shared experience, shared discussion through the whole movement, looking at areas of central spiritual importance, actually feels like both a necessary and a very satisfying thing to do.
Mm-hmm. It's great. It's like that paradox you were saying about the gratitude and the support that requires to go on and on a solitary.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. The sort of the your own practice in that solitary brings you back into relationship with the community and to offering something to the community.
Yeah.
So where would you like to see the International Council moving to?
So it's recently moved to Herefordshire. I think it's this very nice place in Adistana. But I think it's been interesting since I've come back. I think it's almost like since we started to create the structure of the International Council, what we're gradually seeing discussions that have only become possible because we've got that framework in place. And since I came back, there are two or three different discussions where it's starting to become obvious how that the work of the council will evolve. So at the minute, you and I, Dhammamegha, were both very involved in this discussion about a sort of a more thought through, coordinated approach to teaching and to training in the movement. And to have a context where you're able to learn from the experience of practitioners and teachers in the movement internationally, and to be able to sort of use that discussion as a way of sharing best practice, of seeing where developments need to happen. That's an obvious area which we just couldn't have done 3 or 4 years ago. There's a second area, this is a wee bit more hard-nosed, but an initiative that came from the European chairs was something called the Future Dharma Fund. And I think what the Future Dharma Fund is trying to look at, how does the movement grow, again, just to take it down to its most fundamental level, in a way that makes the Dharma widely, effectively available. And the European chairs sort of recognised that although it was their initiative, actually to think most kind of fully about how resources are used, it's useful to have a kind of an international perspective on that. And again, to be able to bring together people from Europe, from the United States and Canada, from Latin America, from Australasia, from India, and to have that as a kind of coordinated discussion, you know, where are the resources, where are the needs, how do the resources and the needs meet each other? Again, just where you're starting to see the International Council gives you a way of doing that that we've really never had before. And, you know, there's other sort of discussions that we've been starting to touch on, but maybe that idea of, you know, really you're starting to look at how you learn from what's becoming now 40, 50 years of Dharma practice in a community. What are we learning from that? How do we practice effectively? How do we teach that? And then thinking about how does the movement grow in a way that makes that experience available? I think those are the central things that we're starting to deal with.